First, I'd like to thank you all for coming to our inaugural event of the year. And I would like to remind you that our next event is Tuesday, September 7th, again at noon. But this event will be in Room D. There will be 5 different kinds of pizza, so there will be pizza for everyone there. Our speaker will be University of Virginia professor and former Clarence Thomas Law Clerk, Sai Krishna Parkash, with commentary from Winnix Professor Seti. The topic will be war, declaration, and delegation. The Federalist Society for Public Policy Studies is a group of conservative and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principle that the state exists to preserve freedom and that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what the law should be. If you'd like to become more involved with the Federalist Society, I encourage you to attend our organizational meeting, which will be Thursday, September 9th in Room 1. There will also be pizza at that event. Today, I'd like to extend a special thank you to former Springfield City Councilor Bruce Stebbins, who was very instrumental in putting together today's event. And I'd like to recognize Professor Jason Mazzone, who is here all the way from the Brooklyn Law School to observe today's event. Also, I'd like to thank the John Templeton Foundation, which is the financial sponsor for our event. And without further delay, I'll turn over the forum to our moderator, Winnix Professor Bruce Miller, who, among other things, teaches a topic very close to this forum on professional responsibility. Professor Miller.
Thanks very much, Isaac, and I think I should probably extend a thank you to the Federal Society for not only allowing but inviting. You know, I guess I can only describe myself as an ideological opponent of almost everything they stand for, so far as I can tell, to be the moderator of this. And thanks for the consistent ecumenical spirit. When I heard the topic from Isaac maybe about a month ago, do class action lawyers get paid too much, my first reaction was, well, yeah, of course, obviously, sure they do. And this stemmed from my own experience as a lawyer who did a lot of class action work. Don't get me wrong, I didn't make a lot of money doing this class action work. I thought that Isaac was talking about the lawyers who defend class actions. And let me give you an example. This is sort of a prototypical ERISA class action case of the kind that I was working on in the 70s and 80s. My office, representing a proposed class of seasonal cannery workers, files a lawsuit against the Western Conference of Teamsters Pension Fund. Arguing that the rules of the fund are skewed in such a way that they'll never get benefits because they're seasonal and never work full time, therefore out of compliance with ERISA. The fund is represented by a major San Francisco law firm. And the firm fights our suit tooth and nail for about 2 years, vigorously opposing class certification, contesting all important discovery, really, in some ways, acting as appropriately vigorous advocates. And in the meantime, billing at what even then was probably about $300 an hour, at least, making a fair amount of money over that two-year period. Well, 2 years of tooth and nail, hotly contested pretrial litigation produces an offer of a settlement from this firm that our clients would have accepted on the day that the suit was filed. And my thought was, well, yeah, they made a lot of money here. They were able, I may be defaming them now, so I guess I better not name the firm. They ran the meter for 2 years and then settled the case. That, to me, counted as too much money. But then I realized I was seeing this all wrong. That it's the plaintiff's lawyers that people are talking about when they're interested in what class action lawyers make. Now, if I look at that from, I don't know if any of you guys have ever been a class member. Anybody ever gotten a class notice in the mail telling them they were a member of a class? You have Barbara and you have two Sarah. I remember the first one I got. It was an antitrust case against Lay's potato chips. Best of my knowledge, I never had voluntarily or knowingly bought a bag of Lay's potato chips. I don't know how I got to be a member of this class. If I was a member, it seemed to me everybody in the universe was. But nevertheless, I was being told that this class action had been filed and was settled, and that I was a beneficiary of the settlement unless I opted out. Here's what it was. It was about, you know, eight figures, the total value of the settlement, somewhere above $10 million. But it was a very, very big class. And what each of us class members was getting as our relief in the class action, because the class was so big, even though the total amount value was large, we were each getting a 15-cent coupon towards our next bag of Lay's potato chips. And at the same time, about $2.5 million of this settlement value was going to the lawyers who filed the case. And my thought there was, well, I don't know if these lawyers are getting paid too much, but this doesn't sound like a bad gig to me. Especially when I looked and saw that the date that the complaint was filed was only 8 days before the judge signed off on the settlement. And I'm thinking, not bad for a week's worth of work. Anyway, that, I hope, is some kind of an introduction to this question. How do you tell whether class action lawyers are getting paid too much? Is it what the market says? Is it the value they add to their clients' lives? Is it the social utility of what they do? Is it how long and hard they worked? What's the measure of this? And I love the question, and I really look forward to what our two speakers have to say about it. Let me tell you briefly something about them. Our first speaker is Professor Brian Fitzpatrick from Villanova, who is a summa cum laude graduate from Notre Dame and magna cum laude graduate from Harvard Law School. He went on from there to clerk for Judge O'Scanlan on the Ninth Circuit, a judge that sent me wishing I could run the other way whenever I drew him in an appeal I was arguing, because he was both very smart and usually not disposed well towards my clients. A great judge. And then clerked for Justice Scalia. He is the author of an article that answers, well, kind of the opposite question to the one we're asking today: do class action lawyers make too little? Our second speaker is Professor Lester Brickman from Cardozo Law School, where he's been teaching since 1976. He's a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, has his JD from Florida Law School, where he received the Order of the Coif, and has a master's in law from Yale, and is noted for his work both on the law of class actions and the policy of class actions, but also on the ethics and law of contingency fee agreements, other professional responsibilities, and asbestos class litigation. So with that, let me turn it over to Professor Fitzpatrick. We'll hear from both, and I think have a chance for questions and answers.
Thank you, Professor Miller. It's a pleasure to be here at Western New England. I've never been here before. I've never been to Springfield. It's a lovely town, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's an honor to be here on a panel with a professor Professor Brinkman. It's a real pleasure to be on a panel with him. He has written quite a bit in this area, and it's been very well received and very good work. So my own view is the class action lawyers, in many cases, do make too little. And this view runs up against the conventional wisdom, as Professor Miller alluded to. And, you know, you don't have to look very far to find examples of this conventional wisdom. A few years ago, the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit put together a task force, and one of the task force assertions was there's a perception among a significant part of the non-lawyer population, and even among lawyers and judges, that class action plaintiffs' lawyers are overcompensated for the work that they do. You know, you can look in newspaper articles, you can look in legal scholarship, and you see statements time and time again, like one of the most heavily criticized class action abuses has been the use of class action settlements to generate huge fees for lawyers and little or nothing for the allegedly injured consumers. That's
one of the criticisms Professor Miller alluded to in his introduction. There was a bill in the Congress, the Class Action Fairness Act 2005. Sponsors of that bill commented that attorneys frequently reap millions in fees while class members are shortchanged. So I think the conventional wisdom is that class action lawyers are too rich. And I want to explain to you today why I think that, at least in many cases, they're undercompensated rather than overcompensated. But before we can assess whether they're under or overcompensated, we have to start, I think, by finding out what they're currently making. And I've been working on an empirical study for the last couple of years that tries to collect all class action settlements in federal court over a two-year period, 2006 and 2007, and it reports some statistics about those settlements, including how much the lawyers are making. So I'd like to share with you the results of this study, all federal settlements, 2006-2007, so we can get a picture of what class action lawyers are currently making. So this first chart here shows the total amount in fees and expenses that judges awarded to class action lawyers in 2006-2007 in federal court. And this chart is in millions of dollars, and I break it down into each litigation subject area, and then at the bottom you see a total figure. That total figure in 2006 is $2.9 billion, and in 2007 it's $2.0 billion. So basically over this two-year period, class action lawyers were awarded $5 billion in attorney's fees. That's just in federal court, and that's a lot of money. And it's even more money than perhaps first meets the eye when you realize that if you look at the top here, the N under each of the years, it's the number of class action settlements there were in federal court in each of those years. Over the two-year period, you're looking at about 650 cases. So in merely 650 cases, class action lawyers are being awarded $5 billion. That's a lot of money. Seems like a lot of money. On this next chart, I add to the bottom of the chart the total settlement value of these settlements. And over the two-year period, the total settlement value is about $33 billion. And so the class action lawyers over this two-year period, depending on the year, they got either 13% or 20%. If you add them up, it's about 15%. 15% of the total settlement value of these settlements that they produced on behalf of their clients. And so this number, 15%, is lower than lawyers typically make in contingency fee litigation. The contingency fees in an individual suits is typically 25, 33, even 40%. And so this number, 15%, is lower than lawyers earn in individual suits. If you look at a distribution of the awards that class action lawyers received in these settlements, you see that most of the settlements were bunched in the 25 to 35% range. There are some settlements quite a bit lower than that, even below 20% of the settlement the class action lawyers were given, and a few settlements above that. But the bulk of the settlements, over 60%, were in the 25 to 35% range. Again, in line with or a bit lower than what lawyers make in individual litigation on a contingency basis. If you take a look not at the distribution but the means and the medians, you see that across virtually every subject area, the mean and median in these suits is 25%. 25% is being awarded to the lawyers. This is, again, a bit lower than we see in individual litigation. The reason why the means and medians are lower, or strike that are higher than the overall sum that class action lawyers get, which is 15%, as I noted, is because judges tend to award class action lawyers much less in fees the bigger the case is. And so what I've plotted here, you see on the left-hand side is the fee percentage. On the right-hand side, you see the settlement amount. It's in natural logs because some settlements were quite big and some settlements were quite small. You see that as the settlement amount gets bigger and bigger, as you go to the right, the fee awarded to the class action lawyer gets smaller and smaller. So over this two-year period, there was one fairly large settlement where the lawyers only got 3%, a security settlement. The biggest settlement in here, the Enron settlement, it was a $6.6 billion settlement, the lawyers got 10%. So these numbers, you know, in some cases as low as 3%, many settlements below 10%, overall 15%, the median case 25%. These numbers are all lower than class action lawyers or that contingency fee lawyers would get in individual litigation. And so this raised the question in my mind is, why do people think that class action lawyers are making too much when the fee percentages they're getting are lower than what individual suit lawyers would get? And I think that much of the reason is because, as Professor Miller pointed out at the outset, in a lot of these settlements, these small stakes settlements where individual class members don't have big injuries, individual class members end up with very little. And so giving a class action lawyer 25% of a $10 million settlement is $2.5 million, but each class member will stand to gain only a small amount of money in these small stakes cases, these consumer fraud cases, these antitrust cases. So there's a disconnect between what the class members see on the form and what the class action lawyers listed on the form. Now, my own view is that in these small stakes cases, despite the atmospherics of 15 cents versus 2.5 million, there really isn't much reason to think that class action lawyers should be getting less. In fact, there's a lot of reasons to think class action lawyers should actually be getting more. And I'm explaining to you why I think that. And I laid out the reasons why I think this in a law review article that was recently published in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review. Before we can answer the question whether 15% is too much or too little, as Professor Miller noted, we have to have some kind of baseline. What do we mean by too much or too little? How much should lawyers be making? And the baseline, right now, judges award fees without much of a normative baseline. The rule of civil procedure says they can award what's reasonable. Judges use a 12, 15 factor test in many cases to kind of guide them on what's reasonable. It doesn't look like there's a whole lot of normative grounding in the awards they end up giving to the lawyers. It looks fairly arbitrary based on intuition and gut reactions. So I think improvement needs to be made just in the normative theory of awarding fees. And the normative theory that I start with when it comes to litigation policy is utilitarian theory. You know, I basically think that we should design our litigation rules to try to increase human happiness, to maximize human happiness. And so I start with a law and economics utilitarian approach to litigation design. The law and economics utilitarian theory of litigation is that litigation basically serves two purposes: to deter wrongdoing and to ensure victims when wrongdoing nonetheless takes place, when injuries nonetheless take place. And these, you know, two goals of litigation should be familiar to both of, to most of you, I suspect. When it comes to deterrence, we want defendants to internalize the cost of the injuries that they throw out onto society. We want them to do this because it creates good incentives for them to avoid causing those injuries in the first place. When a defendant does something that hurts people, if there's a way to avoid hurting people that's cheaper than the harm they cause, we want defendants to avoid the injuries by taking the cheaper safety precaution, for example. The way we get defendants to do that is to force them to pay the costs when they hurt people. Then they can make rational decisions about whether they should take safety precautions to avoid injury. Deterrence is one of the goals, utilitarian goals of litigation. We're all better off if defendants take safety measures that are cheaper than the injuries they throw out onto all of us. The other goal of a utilitarian litigation theory is insurance, that people can be made better off if they can be made whole when they're injured, that people are made better off by paying premiums when they're well, so that when something bad happens to them, they can be made whole again when they're injured. And so when losses are large, you know, when your house is going to burn down or what have you, you'd rather give up your wealth of a little bit of premium every year with the assurance of knowing that when your house burns down, you can rebuild it again through an insurance policy. So these are the two utilitarian goals of litigation. Now, when we talk about how to assess how much class action lawyers should get from the perspective of these two utilitarian goals. As a general matter, it is hard to make an overall statement because these two goals are often working at cross purposes. So the more that you want to deter, the more that you want defendants to internalize costs in order to increase deterrence suggests you should give more and more of a settlement to class action lawyers. Why? Because class action lawyers have to invest in the litigation. It's contingency fee litigation. Their money is at risk. They have to make a decision to invest their money. If it doesn't recover, they get nothing. And so if you wanted to deter defendants, you would want to give incentives to class action lawyers to sue defendants whenever it was cost justified. So for example, let's say that there was a case that had a 50% chance of success, and when it succeeded, it would garner $10 million in judgment. So the expected value of that case is $5 million. Well, if the class action lawyer thought he was only going to get 10% of that, class action lawyer's expected gain from the settlement would only be $500,000. But let's say it cost the class action lawyer $1 million to litigate it. The class action lawyer would never take the case. Expected gain, $500,000, $1 million to litigate, I'm not going to take the case. That means this defendant can cause $10 million of damage or $5 million of damage, take the expected value, without any recourse, without any internalization. So in order to get defendants to internalize as many of the injuries they cause as possible, it's often better to give more and more to the class action lawyer so they have incentives to bring every cost-justified case. Of course, the more and more you give to the lawyer, the less and less the class gets and the less and less of an insurance function that can be performed by litigation. Every dime that's given to the lawyer is a dime less of making people whole when they're injured. And so that has a countervailing negative effect on social welfare, on utility. So as an overall matter, because these things work in cross purposes, it's hard to say whether class action lawyers are making too much or too little. But for one type of case, these small stakes cases that Professor Miller was so concerned about and that most people are so concerned about, I think that these two purposes do not work against each other. I think that, in fact, we can make some conclusions from utilitarian theory about how much class action lawyers should make. In these small stakes cases where each class member has only lost a dollar or 15 cents or $5 or $100, litigation really does not serve an insurance purpose anymore. People are only willing, if you talk to the economists, economic theory, people are only willing to pay premiums when they're well, for insurance when they're injured, when the losses they're insuring against are large, losses for which they are risk averse. If the loss is small, it doesn't make much sense to pay premiums when you're well to insure the loss, because along with your premium is always some administrative charge. Someone's got to run the insurance system. So you're making yourself worse off in the long run. And this is why people typically don't insure themselves for small amounts of money. You know, almost every insurance policy you buy has a deductible for the small amounts. It's only when the amounts are large is it rational to pay premiums to insure yourself. And so litigation really does not serve an insurance purpose in these small stakes cases. The only utilitarian purpose it serves is deterrence. And if that's the case, then the most important thing to do is to make sure that as many of these suits that are cost-justified as possible are being brought. The reason that's the case is because we want defendants to internalize as many costs as they throw out. And so given that deterrence is the only purpose, it's clear that the lawyers should be making as much as we can possibly give them in these cases to incentivize them to bring as many of these suits as possible. And again, if we don't give the lawyers enough money, they won't bring the suits, and defendants will never have to internalize the costs, and they can injure parties without any accountability, which will lead to them injuring people when it would have been cheaper to avoid the injuries. And you know, even if you want to look at this as less through a utilitarian sphere and more through a kind of a moral or justice sphere, you know, these small stakes settlements, the compensation is so small because people have so little injury per party that for the most part, class members don't even take advantage of the compensation. So we give the lawyer 25% or 15%, and then we set aside all this money for the class, and because each class member has so little at stake, none of them even claim their money. This money ends up being lost This is money the defendant ends up not having to pay, for example, if the consumer doesn't cash in their 15-cent coupon. So all those injuries they cause, 75% of them, they'll never even be brought to bear. They'll never even be forced to pay because it's not rational for a class member to even go through the trouble of cashing a 15-cent coupon. So all this deterrence we could have had, we're losing because people don't care about 15% gains. And my own view is that we ought to redirect this money to some place where it can do some good. And in my view, it does some good when we give it to the class action lawyers who invest in these cases because they'll bring more cases and defendants will be forced to internalize more costs. Now, before I turn it over, I'll just note that, you know, the utilitarian theory of a litigation assumes that when cases go to trial or when cases are settled, the damages that are assessed against defendants are optimal damages, that they're equal to the injuries that are caused by the defendant. If the damages are too high, then the litigation system might over-deter defendants. They might take too much safety precaution. When safety is more expensive than injuries, they might still take it. And so when we talk about encouraging more lawsuits, we have to be careful that we don't have a system that encourages settlements that over-deter, where the damages are greater than the injuries caused. And there are some reasons to think that our current system of litigation does over-deter. You know, there are certain areas of the law, securities law, for example, where a lot of people think that the securities laws force defendants to pay damages that are in disproportion to the actual injuries they've caused people. There are statutory damages claims where the legislature has set forth a statutory damage for violations that by design was supposed to overcompensate because so few people brought small-stake statutory claims. When you put those into a class action, there's a real danger of over-deterrence. Some people think that in class action cases, defendants oversettle because they're risk-averse themselves, that they're afraid of going to a jury, having 10,000 class members, one jury trial. You get a bad jury, you're going to have billions and billions of dollars in damage awards. Some people think that defendants settle class actions not because there's any merit to them, because they want to avoid litigation costs and discovery costs, the nuisance value discovery. Those of you who took civil procedure, there's a couple of big Supreme Court cases on this recently, Twombly and Iqbal, where they talk about the defendants and the discovery concerns. So there are lots of reasons to think that maybe litigation is over-deterring as it is. My own personal view is that each of these concerns is important, they are best addressed directly. If there's something wrong with the substantive law that leads to over compensation, excessive damage awards, we ought to change the substantive law. If the one trial, you know, bet the company trial approaching class actions causes risk aversion, we ought to do multiple trials and sample them and then average over the multiple trials to cut down on the risk. If discovery is causing defendants to settle when they shouldn't, we ought to employ some kind of fee-shifting rule in discovery process. I think there are ways to deal with these concerns about overcompensation that are more direct than trying on the back end to adjust the class action lawyer's percentage to account for them. So my own view is that we ought to work on the substance to make sure damages are optimal, and then we ought to try to encourage class action lawyers to bring as many of these small stake suits as possible, because putting the money in their hands, whether we like it or not, does some good. It stops defendants from hurting people in the future. Leaving the money as it is now in coupons that no one claims does a lot of bad. It allows defendants to get off the hook, and it doesn't require them to internalize costs that would make us all better off to internalize. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Professor Brinkman.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity to engage in this debate. Professor Fitzpatrick has argued that lawyers make too little in class actions, in particular in these small stakes class actions, also called negative value class actions. These class actions account for the large majority of class actions brought in this country. In a book I'm publishing at the end of the year titled Lawyer Barons, How Much Their Contingency Fees Really Cost America, I make the case that the costs of contingency fee financing of tort and class action litigation are both extensive and underappreciated. Indeed, nothing more epitomizes the ascendancy of the contingency fee into the pantheon of elemental forces driving our legal and political systems than the contingency fee-driven class action. Now, class actions provide lawyers with what is effectively a giant vacuum to swoop up consumers by the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, to provide the leverage that has compelled virtually every American corporation of over $500 million in assets to pay tribute demanded. Now, even if the great majority of the thousands of consumers conscripted into a class action or a putative class action would oppose it if they were polled, a lawyer need find only one person to act in a representative capacity in order to proceed. Now, as I detail in my book, the benefits that flow from providing incentives for class action lawyers to act as private attorneys general in these negative value cases comes at a considerable cost. I'll just have time to touch on some of these. Now, Professor Fitzpatrick and others argue that class actions deter wrongful conduct. Indeed, as you heard him argue, the more money corporations have to cough up because of class actions, the greater the claimed deterrent effect. This deterrent argument, however, is fundamentally flawed. Many class actions are no more than inventions of fertile lawyers' minds. Businesses can hardly anticipate when they will be subject to liability for performing or not performing an act when the law they are alleged to have violated is amorphous or the alleged injury is mostly pure invention. There is little, if any, empirical evidence that class actions deter fraudulent practice. Scholars' belief in deterrence, and it's widespread, is an article of faith, a conviction that if corporations pay millions to settle, even billions, to settle class actions and enrich lawyers by commensurate amounts, then that must be good for society. And as for the evidence that I and others present, that lawyers often wield class actions as cudgels to extract bountiful fees without any remotely commensurate benefit to society, that evidence is simply dismissed as, quote, a mirage. Moreover, the assumption that payment to settle a class equates with deterrence is without foundation. The fact that a corporation agrees to settle by making a substantial payment does not mean that a wrong has been righted. There is no shortage of wrongful conduct by businesses and corporations. However, the dynamics of the class action apparatus confer an awesome power on lawyers to extract wealth from corporations on the basis of even the flimsiest claims of wrongdoing. Lawyers can impose formidable costs on the companies they sue. Besides legal fees, as you heard from Mr. Miller, they're substantial on the defense side because defense lawyers have a bargain with plaintiff lawyers. The more you sue, the more we defense lawyers make. There's also discovery costs that run into the millions. Even if there's no compelling evidence of fraud or other wrongful conduct, given these substantial costs, most companies are willing to settle a class action for an amount that approximates the cost they would have incurred if they had defended the action, especially if it enables them to avoid a bet-the-company scenario with a 1 in 1,000 chance of losing in front of a jury. According to U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Richard Posner, class action lawyers have been empowered to place, quote, the fate of an entire industry in the palm of one jury consisting of six persons. Though this regulatory power towers over the regulatory powers assigned to various federal and state agencies through our political processes, it has neither been conferred by Congress nor the electorate. Rather, it's the product of a subterfuge the use of a procedural device to create substantive law that bypasses the political process, thus undermining democratic precepts. Judicial endorsement of this expansion of the domain of the class action and the ever-increasing amounts of fees paid to lawyers assures a continuous supply of class action filings. Now, with rare exception, the motivation for exercise of this regulatory power is the pursuit of profit. But the pursuit of profit, of course, is the touchstone of any of our capitalist society, of any capitalist society. But as we well know now, if we didn't know before, unbridled capitalism contains the seeds of its own destruction. Yet class action lawyers, quintessential capitalists, operate in a world largely devoid of regulatory oversight, save that of courts and on very rare occasions the Congress. But judicial oversight is tempered by the judiciary's inclination to advance its own influence over the private sector and the distribution of wealth in society. Indeed, class actions are the ne plus ultra for courts to distribute wealth or redistribute wealth while also increasing their own power. I think the symbiotic relationship between the class action bar and the judiciary is one of the most underappreciated political forces in our society. Now, proponents of the regulatory function of class actions often liken the class action lawyer to the bounty hunter. I think this view of the class action lawyer as bounty hunter is incomplete and misguided. Let me explain. In the Old West, law enforcement staffs were inadequate to handle the level of criminal activity. To supplement these resources, public authorities offered rewards for the apprehension of wanted criminals. Motivated by these financial incentives, bounty hunters set out to capture the fugitive identified by the wanted poster and claim the reward. But the modern-day class action bounty hunter comes with his own printing press. Driven by the opportunity to obtain millions of dollars in fees, the class action lawyer decides who the wrongdoer is, prints that wanted poster, proceeds to file a class action based on that belief. Now, some of the wanted posters correctly identify corporate wrongdoings. But given the amorphousness of many state and federal laws, many of the claims of corporate wrongdoing are at best highly dubious. The alleged acts of wrongdoing are often technical violations of statutes. At worst, they are lawless aggregations of claims of economic loss or fabricated charges. Now, lawyers in class actions are not paid enough. Just ask them. To remedy this situation, lawyers have come up with numerous schemes to increase their fees. And I'm going to touch on some of these schemes. For example, lawyers seek to protect their fees from judicial scrutiny by holding the settlement hostage to the defendant's acquiescence to a fee request and something called a clear sailing provision by which the defendant agrees not to contest their fee request up to a certain amount when it comes before the judge. No court has ever invalidated a settlement because of a clear sailing provision. In fact, these provisions routinely appear in virtually all class actions today. Another area of abuse are settlements where the sole or principal relief is injunctive, that is, where the defendant makes a promise, ultimately enforceable in a judicial proceeding, that the defendant will or will not take certain actions in the future that are alleged to benefit consumers or shareholders. Now, these types of relief are inherently difficult to value and therefore particularly susceptible to abuse in determining the settlement value. In fact, much of the quote-unquote relief that is obtained in these injunctive settlements is illusory, and many of the settlement values announced as being made available to the class are vastly inflated in order to justify equally inflated fee requests. Noted law professors who frequently provide declarations and affidavits to support fee requests in class actions then support the claimed value of the settlement, no matter how ludicrous that claim is. The only ones who realize significant value in these injunctive settlements are the class lawyers and the experts who supported the fee requests. Now, in my book, I discuss how class action lawyers pad their time records. Nonetheless, courts routinely deny fee objectors and other members of the class the opportunity to use discovery to uncover bill padding, if not actual billing fraud. Because of a fee dispute, a falling out among thieves, if you will, in the infamous Bank Boston case, about which some of you may have heard, class action, we have learned that though the lawyer stated that they worked 10,000 hours to justify the $8.5 million fee that was basically embezzled from their clients, the class members, that was more than four times the 2,300 hours the lawyers later acknowledged that they'd actually worked. In my book, I describe other such examples. Now, another ploy that class action lawyers have used to generate unearned fees is the coupon settlement, which Professor Fitzpatrick talked about, where the defendant agrees to issue coupons or some variant to class members who submit the required paperwork entitling them to purchase the defendant's products or services at a discount. The defendant also agrees to pay the class action lawyer a cash on the barrelhead fee, typically calculated as a percentage of the face value of the coupons. The class gets nothing except this discount coupon. To stem these corrupt settlements that were rarely rejected by courts, Congress enacted the Class Action Fairness Act. In fairness, I should point out that class action lawyers have been able to insert huge loopholes into this provision designed to eliminate this scam. So the scam lives on. Now, one of the principal reasons why many settlement values announced as being made available to the class are in reality highly inflated is that the figures are based on 100% class participation in applying for and obtaining the benefit or using the coupons. But class members' response rates are far, far, far lower. We'll see how far momentarily. While class action lawyers and defendants have access to the data on how many class members actually submit claims and what they receive, they not only remain mum, but they also vigorously oppose efforts to bring such data into public view. These attempts, successful attempts, to keep the public in the dark are often supported by the judges presiding over these class actions. Why this reluctance from the bar, the bench, and defendants to allow this information to be disseminated to the public? Because the data would frequently show that the value of the settlement announced as being made available is a phony number, ginned up to justify a substantial contingency fee. A few quick examples. A class action against Intel. In 1996, Intel announced that it overstated the results of speed tests of two of its Pentium microprocessors by about 10%. Almost immediately, lawyers filed class actions claiming that Intel had violated California consumer law. And the ensuing settlement, Intel agreed to include some essentially meaningless disclaimers in its claims about microprocessor performance and to provide the 600,000 customers who bought the Pentium chips with a $50 rebate coupon upon request. Based upon an announced settlement value of $25 million, Intel agreed to pay $1.5 million attorney's fee. But how many of the 600,000 purchasers of the chips applied for this benefit? 156, totaling a sum total of $8,000 paid out. Here's an even more egregious example. For approximately 10 years, Sears Automotive charged car owners for a pricier four-wheel alignment, even on cars which can only have a two-wheel alignment. Sears settled a nationwide class action filed in state court in Illinois by agreeing to compensate class members with $10 cash payments and $4 coupons and to pay class counsel $1.1 million. Now, to justify the fee request, lead counsel claimed that as many as 1.5 million motorists had been defrauded by Sears, estimated that 30% of class members would file for claims, and falsely asserted that 1,900 claims had already been filed by the hearing date. In fact, after the settlement and the fee were approved, 317 valid claims were filed. Based on this number, the entire nationwide class, ultimately received $2,402 in cash and coupons. In other words, class counsel's fee was almost 500 times greater than the real benefit received by the class. So when you see statistics as those put up by Professor Fitzpatrick about 15% of the settlement value or fees, keep in mind those settlement values are often vastly inflated. If you looked at settlement values in terms of reality, that 15% would either be easily be 30, 40, 50%. Now, to collude in jacking up the fees, judges routinely refuse requests from class members to delay awarding part or the entire fee until the payout or benefit actually received by the class can be ascertained so that the fee can be based on the actual benefit. The Epson Prentice case, which I describe in some detail in my book, is a classic example. Lawyers sued claiming that the Epson printer would show a ink out at some point where there was still ink remaining in the cartridge, and the printer would stop. So lawyers sued, of course, that was a heinous crime, and Epson agreed to change its message from ink out to a very amount of ink remains in the cartridge, but it will stop printing at that point nonetheless. So you know when you take that cartridge out, there's still some ink in there, even though you can't use it, which is valuable information. How valuable? Well, this was valued at over $200 million, $220 million, and a fee of $35 million was attested to by another noted law professor scholar. So there was also some coupons thrown in, but the judge deliberately refused to allow the fee to be delayed until they saw how many coupons were actually put in. Now, ostensibly, the reason for the denial by the judge is the availability of the benefit created that counts, not its utility from the point of view of class members. Indeed, the majority of courts have held that the fact that a majority of class members regard the available benefit as not worth applying for is utterly irrelevant. Allowing fees to be based on the announced value of the settlement incentivizes class lawyers to announce settlement values that are ever much blessed by former judges and law professor experts, simply pure fantasy. Now, I think this is a public be damned attitude, and I don't have time to expand on this, but I think it's just outrageous. There are lots of other ways in which class action lawyers can increase their fees, and I'm running out of time, so I just wanted to touch on one more, and that is by structuring a common fund settlement so that the fee does not come out of the settlement but is separately paid by the defendant. You would think that that improves the class's fortunes, but it does not. It's a scam, one more scam. And what happens is this separately paid fee is bulletproof by the lawyers with a clear sailing provision, plus any reduction in the fee goes back to the defendant, not the class. So the incentive for the judge to reduce the fee is considerably reduced. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in an unheralded decision, said that class members do not have standing to contest a fee where the fee reverts to the defendant and not to the class. But this provision in the class, in the settlement agreement, is a clear violation of the lawyer's fiduciary obligation to the class. But when it comes to class actions, fiduciary obligations are just deep-sixed by courts. So what's the final message? When big money talks, ethics walks. Thank you.
Thanks very much to both of you. This was great. I was worried. We were talking at the beginning, would you guys be talking about the same stuff and actually join issue? I think we don't have to worry about that anymore. I know many of you have 1 o'clock classes, and so this is probably the time. But for those of you who could stick around, I hope you will, because I think we have time for questions and answers. I'd like to give, if it's okay, Brian, do you want to say anything first in response, briefly, and then we'll throw it out to the group?
Do 1 or 2 minutes.
Let me give you the mic here.
I appreciate those comments, and actually I think a lot of what Professor Brickman had to say is consistent with some of my concerns. He says that settlement values are inflated because no one in these small stakes cases cashes in their claims. That kind of proves my point. My point is we're not serving any compensatory purpose here. No one wants this money. It's not worth their time to collect it. So the question is what to do about that. What do we do when defendants cause us $5 in harm? Do we try to distribute it to the million of us that were hurt by $5 each? That hardly seems worth it. And when we try to, no one files the form to collect. Do we give it back to the defendants? If we do, then they can rip us off of $5 with impunity, and they'll do it over and over again. Or do we give it to the lawyers? And my own view, the lawyers is maybe the least bad option, because I think it can do some good there. It can give them the incentive to file suit, and the defendants have to pay somebody instead of keep the money for themselves. And by paying that money, they're going to be less likely to cheat us out of $5 in the future. And so the question for me really is this: would I rather collect $5 in one class action settlement, or would I rather give that money to a class action lawyer, which will prevent defendants from ripping me off of $5 100 more times in the future? I'd rather not be ripped off 100 times in the future than collect $5 this one time.
All right, let's open it, Robin.
Of where else can we send the money? I talk about this.
Can you guys hear him okay?
Yeah. That was my pen piece. And the options are the lawyer, the defendant, we assume faculty really can't collect it. Or the third option, some people talk about giving it to the government. Now, my problem with the government is people who have to make decisions on whether to invest in a suit are the lawyers, not the government. And so if we don't give the lawyers, they're not going to have the proper incentive to invest in suits. For a lot of suits they won't take. So I think more good is done giving to lawyers than to government. On the second question, economies of scale, yes. There are economies of scale in class actions. If you wanted to look at it just from some kind of perspective of justice, is it unjust to give class action lawyers more when they do less work per client? Maybe you're right, but if you look at it from a perspective of social policy, what maximizes human happiness, I think in certain suits, more good is done on the deterrent side by giving lawyers more, even if they have less work per client.
Yeah.
So, Professor Fitzpatrick, I have a couple of questions for you. One question is, which kinds of wealth-maximizing cases would be brought that are not currently brought? So, if you were to incentivize more strongly lawyers, which kinds of cases would be brought? And then the second question is, you talk about increasing the amount that lawyers would get in the small-stakes cases, but I never heard of number. Is the proposal 100% of the settlement amount, given everything that you've said? And if it is 100%, then is your argument also that the settlement amount in these cases is too high? Because the lawyers are getting more, and that's all you really care about, is not performing a compensatory function, then couldn't you decrease the settlement amount, give lawyers a much higher percentage, and still produce the results that you're looking for?
So on what kind of cases would be brought aren't being brought now, so it's hard for me to know because you have to know about the cost structure of these cases. So basically, we're talking about cases that are expensive to litigate. Expensive to litigate relative to the expected value of the suit. That's what we're talking about here. Those things with litigation costs are more than 25% of the expected value. Secondly, as a purely theoretical matter, I think 100% is justified in small cases. As a legal matter, you've got the rules of unjust enrichment, you've got the rules of Rule 23. You have state contingency fee caps to deal with. And so could judges actually give 100%? Probably not. But I think they ought to give as much as they're allowed to legally in these small stakes cases. I don't think that means that settlement amounts are too high, because the key question for settlement amount is it equal to the injuries caused by the defendant? Because that's what we want defendants to pay, something equal to their injuries. And so I think those two questions are kind of independent of one another.
Lester, you want?
I'll just two quick comments. First, with regard to the $5 per person illegal charge or whatever it may be, what I tried to put forth in my remarks is how facile that comment is, that a lot of these claims of wrongdoing are simply inventions of very fertile minds and lawyers. And to assume that the $5, that there's an extra $5 charge on your charge account or something that's illegal, that's a simple case. But that's rarely what these class actions are about. So the $5 itself is simply the means to the lawyer's end, which is fees. Second, on the issue of economies of scale, your name, Robin, is it? You're just right on. There are vast economies of scale in discovery and so on, with class actions, with tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, compared to the individual costs of a personal injury litigation involving one client. Courts have failed to demand, require, impose that lawyers share those economies of scale with their clients. In theory, lawyers' fees must be, quote, reasonable, rule 1.5 of the model rules and so on. In reality, when it comes to class actions, those rules are simply deep-sixed. Courts do not require that kind of a sharing, and there are other subterfuges lawyers use now to get around even the limited control that courts exercise on fees, which is, instead of a class action, to represent 10,000 or 20,000 individual claimants in a consolidated case of an MDL, where there is no, perhaps there is no authority by the court to regulate fees at all. They're charging 40% in mass tort cases in these individual consolidated claim proceedings. Three federal judges have knocked down that 40%, but I'm sure that's going to be appealed, and we'll have to see whether they have the authority to do so.
John?
Isn't the more basic question that class action lawsuits, in essence, are unconstitutional, if not unconscionable, and that by some mystical or magical power, we've taken an individual right, made it a collective right, and furthermore, the judges, which you might not have mentioned, concept of just grabbing whatever money is and throwing it to some deserving charity, which more power to them, but, or giving it to these lawyers, isn't that just another miscarriage of justice and another way of removing what ought to be rightfully given to these people in the class? But we don't really care about these individuals or their rights because we're in a whimsical land of fancy called class action. And it's just a false hope.
Well, I think that any right that you have to sue someone for $5 is not much of a right at all, because no one is going to spend the money to sue someone for $5. So when we say you're taking away your right to sue for $5, you're taking away something you really didn't have to pay. Moreover, in these damages cases, before your claim is extinguished, you do have the right to opt out. Now, the opt-out rates are very small in these cases. People think it's because it's not worth anyone's time to read the settlement form because they stand to gain so little. But again, it just proves the point. They stand to gain so little, it's not worth their time to read the form. It wouldn't have been worth their time to sue. And so when we talk about we're taking away rights, I think we're doing class members more good by deterring defendants from ripping them off in the future than we are by preserving some right they've never been exercised.
Sam? Oh, go ahead, Lester.
I think you're onto something, though. I'm not constitutional on the strong board here, but nonetheless, what happens in a class action is a magical event. A contract claim, a breach of contract claim, when it becomes part of a class action, transmogrifies into a tort claim.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, Rule 23 is a procedural rule. Under the rules
creating the procedural rules. Procedural rules cannot have substantive effect. But in fact, class actions are a procedural device masquerading as substantive law and have an enormous impact in a substantive way. And now this is hotly debated by scholars. I would refer you to some of the published writings in this area. It's too complex for me to, try to sketch out now.
Sam?
My view is that I've spent an entire chapter in my book on the question of judicial bias, is that judges, like all of us, would like to increase their salaries, but they can't do so. But in substitution for something, they increase their power, they increase their scope of authority, and that generates a higher level of status in society. And I think this is pretty well documented, although obviously I'm not stating something that's written in stone. But I think that if you read a Fordham Law Review article, a very short article by Judge Denny Jacobs, who was Chief Judge of the Second Circuit, he candidly acknowledges what I've never seen a judge ever say in Britain before, which is the bias in favor of lawyers vis-a-vis the rest of society. And he illustrates that. And there's an article by Ben Barton at Tennessee, and I've written an article about the bias of the judiciary. When judges enlarge the scope of class actions, they're also enlarging their own scope of authority to regulate society, to regulate the distribution of resources. And that's what I think is taking place. So when you ask me, are judges not inclined to do so, I'm saying they are inclined to do so. They're inclined to augment their power, which, by the way, every group in society seeks to do. But judges are in a unique position to do so, and I think they've accomplished a great deal from that perspective in this regard.
In terms of that motivation, they would be the same. But
the motivation is the same, but statistically speaking, federal courts are more likely to dismiss a class action, to not certify a class action than state courts. But we've seen instances of pretty, corrupt state court judges. I'll use corrupt in the sense of corruption of a process. That gave standby class action certifications. That's why you have CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, because of Madison County, Illinois, because of things that were going on in Alabama, in these small towns, in Texas and so on, where the judges and the lawyers, were in each other's pockets.
Isaac has given me the high sign that we've got to end here pretty soon. Robin, let me let you get the last question in here.
Professor Brickman has a chapter in his book about cyfray abuse. I don't know if you do, but there's a lot of people who are very concerned about what judges are doing.
There was a proposal Robin floated in print maybe, 25 years ago when I was a jurisprudence teacher. I ran across it, and I think it might have been written by Jules Coleman, who's a wonderful thinker, lawyer on these topics. And he proposed something along these lines. Everybody seems to agree that the compensatory side of the 23B3 class action is illusory. All of us seem to agree on that. You both do, and you do, and everybody does. So now, what can, if anything, be done to keep the what Brian calls the deterrence side alive? Well, Coleman's proposal, if I'm remembering him as the author, was to completely give up the idea of any compensation. Go to the 100%. There might be some standing to sue problems with that, but as a matter of policy, give it up so that the entire negotiation, to begin with, is over the fees and what the fees will be. And this, he argued, diminishes to some extent the problem of amorphous substantive law. I don't know if it really does, but a big problem here is the substantive law being so amorphous. That's what allows this to be inflated. There still have to be judicial approval. The judge would decide what share the lawyers get. It's just fees, and they don't necessarily even get all of it. The rest of it goes to a foundation, and their job is to finance additional B3 suits to sort of just keep the chain letter rolling so that it never ends. That is, there's an escrow account that can only be used for deterrence suits. That was it. You know, he meant this as like a Swiftian piece, a modest proposal. Now I'm ready to take him halfway serious. Thank you guys so much for coming and doing this. It was great.